Good evening, everybody, and welcome to tonight's Radio EduTalk. Delighted to have on the show tonight Paul McKelvey, and I'm going to get... Paul has many titles, but I'm going to get this one right. He's a Scottish Commissioner to the UK Commission for Employment and Skills. I think that's right, Paul. And
yeah, that's right.
Fantastic. I've been practising that all week. And... what we're going to be talking about this evening for the next half an hour or so is looking at trends and challenges for young people in the world of work. So just before I ask you to kind of formally introduce yourself, Paul, and give us a bit of background to your career in industry and in working in various organisations and with the government, I'll just say to listeners to the live show that you can get in touch at any point if you've got any comments or questions for Paul. You can email edutalker@hotmail.co.uk, that's edutalkr, and you can also, if you're on Twitter, just put something up and include the hashtag edutalk. Understand Paul has some presence online also, and no doubt later on in the show you'll be able to find out how you can contact him direct. So just to start off, Paul, if you could give us a bit of background to your career.
Yeah, my background is very much a business background. I had a long career with Scottish Power that ended in 2007. And during my time there, I headed up the retail organisation's training function. Then I moved into an interesting initiative that the company had called Scottish Power Learning that ran the company's e-learning program but was also involved in the company's community learning activities. And then latterly I was the Director of Corporate Responsibility at Scottish Power. And I left at the back end of 2007 and I've developed what I politely describe as a portfolio career, which means that I've got a range of things that I do. So I have my own consultancy. But then I have three public appointments that I'm involved in. So as you mentioned, I'm on the board of the UK Commission for Employment and Skills, and I guess that's the main hat that I'm wearing this evening. But I'm also a board member of both the Scottish Funding Council, which is the public body that funds Scotland's universities and colleges, and Skills Development Scotland. So a really interesting mix of things, but very much in the kind of skills and learning arena.
Thanks very much for that, Paul. And you'd really talk to us this evening about challenges and trends. So I just feel free to start off from whichever point you wish, but just wonder if you can give us maybe some kind of context about how the labour market and the world of work, so to speak, has changed in recent years and in what ways it continues to change.
Good, I will do. I thought I might do three things. First of all, just tell you a little bit about the UK Commission so that everyone understands what it does and what it doesn't do. And then do exactly as you've asked and kind of outline what some of the real challenges are that are facing young people in the labour market. And then finally, maybe propose some of the ways in which I think we could all make things a little bit better for the next generation as they seek to kind of enter the tricky world that is employment. And if that makes sense, I'll just kick off. So the UK Commission is a UK-wide public body that kind of has three main objectives. Firstly, to provide really good labour market intelligence to help businesses and people make good choices. And secondly, to maximise the impact of employment and skills policies across the UK and employer behaviour to help drive jobs growth and an internationally competitive skills base for the country. And thirdly, to work with sectors and business leaders to develop and deliver the best solutions that will maximise employer investment in skills, because we believe that a skilled workforce will be a competitive workforce. And I was hoping this evening that I would draw on some of the research work that the Commission has done to illustrate what some of the challenges are that our young people currently face and will continue to face. So in a report that we published last year called the Youth Employment Challenge, the Commission reported that the causes of the UK's high level of youth unemployment, are largely structural, and the rise during the recession is mainly down to the level of economic demand. But the film, though, that employers haven't been recruiting as many young people, largely because there's been a drop off in recruitment generally. So under half of Scotland's employers have recruited in the past year. And only 26% of employers have recruited a young person. So a return to growth and a significant rise in vacancies will both be necessary for employment levels to return to pre-recession levels. Now that's fine, and that's all about the current state of the economy. And if that was the only problem, then you could argue that when the economy recovers, all will be well. But there are structural barriers, I think, that are becoming particularly difficult for young people. And I'd like to focus on three areas in particular. One, the changing shape of the labour market. The second, changes that are happening in the way that employers are recruiting young people. And finally, on the importance of work experience. So on the changing shape of the labour market, young people tend to be clustered around sales and elementary occupations, bar staff, waiters, cleaners, certainly as their first job. And they account for half of all young people in employment across the UK, as opposed to only 15% of adults that are working, so largely dominated by young people. And over the course of the recession and recovery, the picture for these occupations is one of net stagnation. There are 145,000 fewer people employed across the UK in these occupations than there were before the recession. By contrast, high-skilled managerial and professional occupations have seen ongoing growth over the last few years. So there are 930,000 more people in these high-skilled occupations, even during that period of recession and recovery. And then the jobs in the middle are pretty stagnant, really showing no significant increase. So these changes mean that young people are competing with older and more experienced workers who've been forced to trade down for the lower and mid-level jobs that young people would normally take. Meanwhile, those higher-level growth jobs, the ones that I mentioned that have increased significantly, only tend to be available at best to graduates. So it's becoming more difficult, I think, for young people to get on the first rung of the career ladder, if you like. So that's part of the problem, the shape of the market. But the way that recruitment works is also a key part of this story. And there are a number of ways in which recruitment practices disadvantage young people. First of all, informal methods such as recommendations from personal contacts are still a major way for people to find work. These informal connections tend to be built up over time and through experience of work, so young people are far less likely to have them. Those that don't are at a significant disadvantage, so word-of-mouth recruitment we find particularly prevalent in smaller and younger organisations, many of the organisations that we see as being the potential for growth in our economy, and also with employers who have predominantly high-skilled professional and managerial roles. And as I've just outlined, those are the jobs that are set to grow, and that creates yet another barrier for young people trying to get into work. And then finally, a quick point on graduate recruitment. The number of recent graduates has increased by 50% in recent years, from 1 million to 1.5 million. And this has led to a situation where employers seek graduates for jobs that do not necessarily require that level of skill to do the job effectively. So that further disadvantages young people that have got fewer qualifications. So there's the recruitment challenge, but what about the employers that don't recruit young people at all? And we asked employers in Scotland through some of our research work why that was the case. The majority chalk it down to the fact that no young people applied. Well, that might be because of word-of-mouth recruitment methods are leading to hidden vacancies for young people. Or it may be because the only jobs that are available are the higher skill jobs which require more skills and experience that young people have not been able to gain. Both of these are indirectly linked to young people's lack of experience, and that's the second major reason that employers gave us for not employing young people. So no young people applied, and the quality or lack of experience were the two top reasons that employers gave for not recruiting young people. Now that's bizarre, because to kind of debunk a myth about the employability of young people, employers across the UK generally find that young people are very well prepared for work, and employers in Scotland report higher levels of work readiness among school and college leavers compared to elsewhere in the UK. So, for example, 68% of employers who hired secondary school leavers in Scotland found them well prepared for work, as did 82% of employers who took on FE college leavers. Similarly, higher levels of employers felt that Scottish university leavers were well prepared for work at 86% satisfaction. So only a minority of employers find young people poorly prepared for work. But where they do, the main reason they give is lack of experience. So between the recruitment practices and the reasons for not employing young people, we can see that experience is valued the most when recruiting young people, and also when they eventually get into work. So what young people need more than anything else is experience, but as we've seen, the issues around the structure of the labour market and recruitment are hindering their move into work, resulting in a catch-22 situation whereby young people can't get a job without experience, but can't get experience without a job. So clearly an upturn in the economy will reinstill some confidence in employers to recruit. Meanwhile, there is a lot, I think, that employers and others can do to ease the transition into work for our young people and give them more opportunities to gain experience. I think one thing that we can do is dispel some of the myths around young people's work readiness and their ability. And to me, it seems that there's a very clear business case for recruiting young people, and we need to make that case loud and strong. Young people bring attitudes and behaviours that can be used to support business growth. Employers who recruit younger people often do so because young people are very willing to learn new skills, to work differently, and to bring fresh perspectives and ideas into the workplace. Employers actually report themselves that the benefits of recruiting young people are realised over time. Bringing new talent into organisations improves succession planning, increases loyalty, reduces turnover, and therefore increases profitability. So on to the final part of my talk this evening. What do we do about it? I guess the key thing. Well, I think there are a number of things that we can do to help here. I think, first of all, employers can make recruitment less dependent on informal contacts and use more open recruitment methods. Secondly, I think we need to create more opportunities for non-graduates, including apprenticeships, so create more routes into the labour market for our young people. Thirdly, I think we need much more proactive engagement between employers and education. And I think that there's a two-way street here. All too often, I think employers blame the education system, and the education system say that employers are inflexible. Well, I think we need to think about creative solutions there. Fourthly, I think we need to move beyond thinking of work experience as a 1 or 2 week spell at age 14 to 16, and think of a much broader range of ways that young people can become engaged with the world of work. Fifthly, we should be looking at embedding work experience into every area of our education system so that learning and working are seen as being inextricably entwined. Sixthly, I think we need to make sure that in our policy, our skills policy for employers, we don't keep on inventing new programs all the time. Employers find it difficult to keep up to speed with the different ways that they can be supported to recruit a young person. Let's not keep changing the goalposts so that we've got a new fad that comes in every couple of years. And finally, I think we can do more to ensure that our young people are both well informed about the nature of the workplace by all of the people that they trust, and that when they are exiting the education system, that they are fully supported into work. So in conclusion, we are in a very difficult and challenging economic environment. And it's difficult for us all, but it's particularly difficult for our young people due to some of the structural and recruitment challenges that I've mentioned during my talk. But I do think there are things that we can do to help improve prospects for the next generation. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Paul. Absolutely fascinating. John, what do you think?
Yeah, I do. I think we need to be careful. I don't think what we should be doing is directing people that are at primary school level towards specific careers at that stage in their lives. They've got a long journey to travel as they kind of go through the whole of the education system. But I do think that young people understanding the types of exciting jobs that are out there can inspire them and create ambition and goals for young people. So, many of the choices that we end up making in our lives are influenced by what happens in our primary school life. So we can make, I think, very often the activities that happen in our schools more exciting and more interesting by bringing people from outside the organisation, outside the school organisation, to make the learning different in nature. So involvement by employers in primary programmes, I think, can create real excitement in our young people about their future lives. So I think there is absolutely a role there. The other thing I would add is the very skills that we see being used by people in primary and in terms of working across subjects, problem solving, creativity, are the very skills that the UK's future workforce will absolutely need. So we need to try and find a way of capturing that and making sure it doesn't get lost through the secondary phase. Yes. Yeah. And it becomes very real. I think one of the challenges around career choice, you know, if you ask young people who influences them most in terms of what they're going to do with their career, right at the top of the list we find parents, and thereafter we find teachers and peers. And it's only when you go a little bit further down the list do you find careers professionals appearing in that list. So the importance of broadening the horizons of our young people so that they understand all of the opportunities that are out there, rather than just the opportunities that their parents took up or are aware of, I think is a very important thing as we help people think about the wide range of opportunities that will be available to them. I do. Yeah, I'm having both primary and secondary, to be honest, and I've not been heavily involved in understanding in any detail Curriculum for Excellence, but I do know that in Curriculum for Excellence, within one of the areas, there is an absolute desire to for teachers to help build some of the career management skills that we want our young people to build. So, you know, the challenge around careers information is that many of the jobs that people are doing today didn't exist for school leavers when they were in primary. And so the world of work is an ever-changing world. So we need to build young people that have got the ability to manage their careers and seek out the information that they will need on which they can make informed choices about what they're going to do beyond school. We need that knowledge to be shared, not just with young people themselves, but also those who advise them, and that includes teachers. Bye.
No problem at all. And hopefully the listeners can hear me fine. Just before I come in, I probably like John, Paul, I've got so many questions following on from your very succinct and clear introductory talk. So just remind listeners that if you have a question or a comment for Paul McElvey, our guest this evening, you just email edutalker@hotmail.co.uk. Or if you're on Twitter, just include the hashtag edutalk. Paul, I'm wondering about secondary school provision within Scotland. And you know, you said that you have admitted your kind of limited knowledge of the new curriculum. But just in your experience, would you say that there are school subjects that we still deliver within the secondary or senior phases of education that really have had their time and have to be written out of existence. And in a similar vein, other subjects that are kind of on stream, so to speak, nowadays that you think young people in schools, I suppose, as providers need to take a more serious look at and to try and get staff in place that can actually run with these kind of new and more relevant programmes?
Yeah, well, on the first, I don't think that there are subjects that are irrelevant for the modern world in schools. You know, I didn't explain what my education had been beyond school, but I went and I left school and I went and studied foreign languages at university. And you could say, well, what was the point in doing that, Paul? You never used them. More important than the content, if you like, the topic, the knowledge, is how you learn how to use knowledge. So for me, it's the skills and aptitudes that you can gain through learning that are actually much more important than the specific facts or content of that learning. So the ability to be creative, to solve problems, to deal with complex issues, to communicate effectively, both written and verbal, to work in teams. These are skills that will be required in the workplace, I think, for as long as I'm around. And they are all skills that can be learned and embedded in just about any subject. I think where the really exciting thing happens in school education is where subjects bump into each other and where teachers work collaboratively across a range of subjects to bring something to life. We talked earlier on about the opportunity for employers to make learning inspirational by bringing their experience into the classroom. I think the same thing can happen by encouraging school teachers to think about where their areas of expertise and their subjects can collide together to create even more interesting learning for the learner. And then think about the applicability of that learning beyond school. And that's why I think we always need to play back into the school system what the world beyond school is like, because the purpose of school mustn't just be about getting people through exams. It must absolutely be about preparing young people for life beyond school and helping them to maximise their potential. So for me, actually, the subject is less of an issue as long as it makes sure that it's kept up to date. I think there is an important point there. We mustn't be teaching IT skills that belong to the 1990s. But we should still be teaching IT skills. But we must make it relevant for the destinations that our young people are moving to.
And you seem to be suggesting that, forgive me if I've picked this up wrong, Paul, but you seem to be suggesting that possibly with some of the organisations that you're involved in and maybe your own personal opinion that, you know, there are some radical ideas possibly germinating with regards to how to increase young employment for young people across the UK. I mean, I'm just wondering, have you been engaging with any ideas about, for example, where the school leaving age sits and where it might do in the future, or how the kind of senior phase of secondary, you know, kind of 15, 16, up to 18 might be more differently structured, maybe in relation to how, so I'm kind of leading down your path here, but possibly in terms of the relationship between senior learners within formal education and the local economy, local industry, and indeed kind of social enterprises in the wider community, and I suppose whether they spend, maybe the case that they should be spending less time within the school walls and more time as young adults out in the community at an earlier age?
Well, certainly the evidence would say, you know, as I mentioned in my talk, that access to the world of work improves the chances of a young person moving into sustainable employment. So if that's what the evidence says, then we should be trying to make sure that all of our systems, in compulsory and post-compulsory education, help that to happen in a way that improves the chances for young people and doesn't disadvantage them compared to the rest of the population that are looking for work. Now, if we were reinventing an education system tomorrow from scratch, and we're not, but if we were, then we might not put the strong gates that exist at each transition point that exists in our system. So, you know, we have a number of gates that happen in our system that can sometimes prevent us from creating the best solution for our young people. So, yes, I would like, personally, this is a personal view, I would like to see work experience embedded in more learning at every stage of the education system, both in the compulsory system and also in the beyond school system. I would like to see more higher level qualifications that have got a stronger work-based element than exists at the moment, because I think that benefits the young person, it benefits the employer, and it benefits the learning provider, whether that be a college, university, or training provider beyond school. And I do think that we need to make sure that our system is flexible enough to allow us to do that. And I guess the final thing I would say is, and this has been talked about a lot for a long time, and I don't know what the answer to the question is, we also need to make sure that when we are advising young people on their post-school choice, that we don't always see university as the best answer for every young person. Sometimes a work-based route is right if the individual's career aspirations or their learning style or their individual ambition means that a work-based solution such as an apprenticeship is a better solution. We shouldn't be going academic is always good and vocational is always bad, because to me that makes no sense.
Just apologise to listeners at this point. I believe that John, possibly listeners are continuing to find it difficult to hear John, so he may join us again later as we come into the last kind of 5 or 10 minutes of tonight's show, or he may just send some questions to me over Skype and I'll relay them on to Paul. Just one final question from me at this point. You mentioned about the importance, as Immersory researched, the importance of informal connections to for a young person to secure employment. Yeah. Now, I work with a number of young people who would be termed as at risk, and we've had people on the show before talking about how to grow or create social capital and other forms of capital. So I just wonder whether all schools, if we assume that all schools have at-risk young people attending, should be doing more to focus on enabling these young people to build up more informal and enriching connections with industry and elsewhere to see them okay once they leave.
Yeah, I think that would be a good idea. I think that there's two sides to the coin. You know, if informal recruitment practices disadvantage a group of young people, then I think we should equally be encouraging employers to have much more open recruitment when they are looking to bring new people into the workforce. So, you know, and we hopefully by doing that you will reduce the amount of that informal recruitment that happens. But on the basis that it's always going to happen, the better networks that we can develop at the back end of school and beyond, in terms of connections into employers, the better. But we should also make sure that where there are publicly funded programs out there that, if you like, de-risk the employment of young people into a business, that both young people and their advisors and employers are aware of those. You know, and right across the UK, there are a number of programs out there run by public organisations that provide financial subsidies or training or other types of support to employers to recruit a more at-risk young person. And I think that's a good thing to do. It helps to kind of rebalance the playing field for those people that are finding it most difficult. But I agree, if we can improve those networks for our youngsters, then it will minimise their disadvantage.
Thanks, Paul. Going to try another question, and I'm listening on another earphone to see if I'm coming through or not, but this kind of links into, I know quite a few young people are leaving university at the moment and finding that they have to do a lot of pro bono work.
Yes.
And this to me, this seems like a really dangerous system to be in, because we're going to lose an awful lot of people who basically couldn't afford to do it. There's jobs in, you know, particular industries that you really seem to need to do something for free and need to be able to afford to work for free for a time. And I wonder if there's any way that can be combated.
Yeah, I think that's a very difficult one, and I guess sometimes it's about at what point does the state interfere in the kind of free market economy that we have, and I guess there's an ethical question in there. On the one hand, you know, it's very clear that work experience, that pro bono work experience, will be good for that individual young person. Put aside the fact that they're not being paid for it, the very fact of doing it will give them an advantage in relation to securing paid employment down the track. The challenge then is, how do you then make sure that you don't create an unequal system for those that can't afford to do that? And I think there must be opportunities there for the state to look how it might help to ensure that people can take advantage of those types of options without having to rely perhaps on more affluent parents, for example.
Yeah, I mean, that's basically, I think, the nub of the matter, that is, if you've got supportive parents, or parents that I don't mean supportive, and financially supportive parents, you're at a great advantage. And I think maybe especially in the current economic times. So I would have thought there would have been... politically naive, but I would have thought there would have been an opportunity for the state to say,
yeah, well, I certainly think that I don't know enough about the regulations about what people can do when they are claiming benefit for unemployment, but to me it seems a bit counterintuitive if we're not allowing people to do unpaid work and punishing them twice. I would be strongly against the idea of removing benefit from someone if what they're doing is gaining unpaid work to help them to develop a career. So, I would hope that the policymakers in that space would ensure that they're helping, particularly those disadvantaged young people that a lot of our discussion this evening has been based around, aren't further disadvantaged by not being able to do that. Yeah, I think that sometimes the work experience problem can be that you end up, depending on how work experience is measured at a school level, that you end up slotting everyone somewhere, even if it's not the right thing for the individual. I think what we need to do with work experience is two things. First of all, take it seriously, and everyone needs to take it seriously. So the... in this situation, the school needs to take it seriously, the careers professionals need to take it seriously, and the employers need to take it seriously, so that the work experience that we're providing is valuable and is not just slotting someone somewhere so that we can tick they have completed their work experience box, because that isn't work experience. It needs to be enriching, valuable, embedded learning that will help the young person and demonstrate that they have the skills that the world of work needs, and also will help them think about what they might want to do when they eventually move into work. And I'm not against work experience happening outside the private sector, work experience in schools or in local authorities or in hospitals or anywhere else, but we should try and make sure that the work placements that we're putting young people into are appropriate to their capabilities and their aspirations. So if you want to be a primary school teacher, why would you not want to get your work experience in a primary school? Yeah. Now that's another topic altogether. That could be my next slot.
Paul, I've just got a couple of questions just to finish up, and I'm conscious that we're just coming to the end of the show. Can you say a bit more about what you mean by, you mentioned a couple of times tonight, open recruitment practices, what's the kind of best practice that's out there, what is making a difference? And also in terms of HENFE students, how can they go about influencing those sectors to better meet their needs?
Yeah, well, first of all, on the open recruitment practices, I think it's about making sure that when we are advertising, well, two or three things I would put in here. First of all, I think we need employers to think more strategically about their overall workforce structure, in the shape of the workforce, and that they don't, when they lose a highly skilled person, think that the only way to resolve that is to replace them with a highly skilled person. We should be, organisations of middle and larger size should be thinking about a kind of talent pipeline that runs right through their organisation, with school leavers and graduates at the entry level of their organisation, moving right through to the higher levels of the business, and looking wherever they can to grow their future managers and senior professionals. So that's kind of one thing about workforce design. But when they do go out into the market to look for people, then they should think about how they cast their net as widely as possible and do all that they can not to limit who might apply for the job and as a result limit the kind of people that they will get into their business. And I think all too often employers just continue just to fish in the same pool that they've always fished and not think about really what do I need here. Back to the point that we go on about graduates, you know, we see lots of employers employing graduates in lower skilled jobs because they can. Well, I'm not sure that's necessarily the right thing for the graduate, and it's certainly not the right thing for the very able non-graduate that could have done that job. So I think those are a couple of pointers that I would say around what would make good practice from a recruitment perspective. On to the second question about what we can do with further and higher education. You know, one thing I would say is there is no one out here in the education system trying to do the wrong thing. Everyone is trying to do the right thing, including those in our colleges and universities. But I think we need to make sure that, as far as possible, our colleges and universities face into their key stakeholders effectively, so that they face out into the labour market effectively, and they also face back in to the school system from which their future students will come, so that we create an education system that, from the learner perspective, is full of smooth transitions, not bumpy transitions. And I think that would make a big difference. I think there's more work to be done there as well.
Well, I think maybe the message is, and I'm hoping people can hear me now, Paul, the message is that more work needs to be done, but an awful lot of what you've been saying tonight sort of parallels things that we've touched on in the Curriculum for Excellence, that sort of experience, and that seems to be perhaps what employers will need.
Great.
I think we're just about done. I'd just like to say thanks very much, because this has been really interesting for me, for lots of sort of personal reasons, family reasons, and things I can see going on about round about me. And it's really nice to hear things that sound like really powerful common sense coming from somebody in a leadership position. So it gives us, I think, a lot of hope.
Well, that's very encouraging. you know, what we need to do with all of this stuff is make it real. You know, it's fine, you know, taking high-level research and saying, well, what does that say? But we then need to translate the lessons from that and make that, you know, if you like, make that work for our young people. And, you know, we talk about, you know, use words like pupils and learners. We don't very often talk about young people as being the customers of the education system. But if we can make them informed customers of the system, then that has to be the right thing in terms of their future capability. So I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to come and chat with you tonight.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And people can follow you on Twitter, where you're Paul, is it Paul J?
Paul J. McKelvey, yeah.
Paul J. McKelvey. And if you have any useful links and things, you'd maybe send them over via email, and we can add them to the show notes. Is there any way you could point people to, as a sort of, they're interested in finding out more, as a sort of first base?
Yeah, no, I will. I'll zap you some stuff in the next couple of days.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
Good stuff. Thank you very much. Right. Good night, all.
Good night.